So.
Yes.
Dr.
Makes it
Hirata.
sound fancier. You don't pulmonate, you respirate.
Well, that's true. Okay, you win. Dr. Hirani, are you available to be part of the chat too?
Yes, I am. This is Amjad Hirani. I'm from St. Louis Children's Hospital, one of the pediatric pulmonologists over there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. We also invited Dr. PJ McShane, who is in Tyler, Texas. She's an adult pulmonologist. And I don't believe she's on the line. As you know, adult pulmonologists are just crazy busy right now. So all of the participation was tentative on what they need to do for their patients. So I think we'll just go ahead with Dr. Hirani and Dr. Shapiro. And if Dr. McShane can join us, that would be great. First of all, thank you all so much for joining this town hall. We didn't have a specific agenda for this. We just wanted to give people an opportunity to ask questions. This is a frightening time for all of us. And we thought it would be helpful if we could all talk. There's a lot of confusing and sometimes conflicting information coming out about how to manage patients with chronic underlying illnesses in the of coronavirus. So as of course we have a lot more questions than we actually have answers, but we need to at least give people an opportunity to talk about what they're concerned about. One thing I thought it would be nice of us to do as a patient community is collectively thank our medical professionals on the front line for what they're doing every day as this gets to be more and more challenging. I think their job is pretty horrible, as we can imagine. So if you would like to be a signatory on just a card thanking them, just please send your email to Lynn Ernie at pcdfoundation.com. It's L Ernie at pcdfoundation. Oh, I'm sorry, .org, pcdfoundation.org. All right. So Dr. Hirani and Dr. Shapiro, we have a couple of questions to start with. Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure.
Okay, so the first one, my son is 20 and has immotile cilia syndrome. Progression to ARDS has been happening very fast in admission to the hospital for many relatively healthy patients. Taking into consideration his underlying disease, if he becomes symptomatic and COVID-19 is a concern, should he be hospitalized even if his symptoms are mild?
Amjad, do you just want to flip back and forth? I'll take this one, you take the next one.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So I think one of the worst places you can be right now is a hospital. So I think everyone should realize that. Staying in your home is by far the safest place you can possibly be. That being said, if you're having respiratory distress, each hospital and local institution is going to have rules about who they're admitting. So there's very little control. It's going to be very hard for you to show up at a hospital and say, I'm COVID-19 positive or coronavirus positive, but I feel good other than a little cough. They're not going to admit you. They need the beds for other people. And there's no real treatment they're going to be doing to prevent it from worsening other than supportive treatment, like giving you fluids, maybe intravenously if you can't drink, giving you oxygen, things like that. So there is no role right now for a preemptive hospitalization if you're still doing okay. And in fact, from what we're seeing, the vast majority of people, even with underlying conditions, will still do okay. The fact that your son is 20 years old is the best thing he's got going for him right now, because the younger you are, the less severe these infections are. I can't say that's going to be the case for every kid with an underlying illness in the respiratory system, but that's the best we've got right now.
You know, maybe a good point to make, and it kind of plays into this, we are unaware of, at this point, any PCD patient who has tested positive for coronavirus. That doesn't mean they're not out there and we're just not aware of it, but we do not know of anybody in our group so far that's tested positive.
Okay.
And I should say, at our center, where we follow a lot of cystic fibrosis kids, we've not had any CF kids who are kind of the cousin to PCD test positive either.
So again, this is Amjad from Children's Hospital, and I just kind of reiterate what Adam said. One, we have not admitted any PCD kids during the coronavirus, but this might change as we see more cases. And we haven't seen a surge in cystic fibrosis admissions. But again, the best place to be is at your home right now. If you're having symptoms, I would encourage you to contact your PCD physician, just kind of run that by them. I would not change regular treatment just because you have a COVID. So mild patients should definitely stay at home. Patients that have significant disease might end up needing to come to the hospital, but that need to be arranged with the physician so that the hospital is aware that such a patient is coming. We know that at Children's Hospital, we have some protocols to try to seclude or kind of put patients with suspected COVID in a different place in the emergency room coming in. So depending on your hospital, that might need to take place as well.
Okay, thank you. Just a reminder, if you type your question into the chat bubble at the bottom, we will see it off to the right-hand side. So that's where you can ask questions and we'll be following those. The next question is, how can caregivers and loved ones living with someone with PCD protect them? Are there protocols for not bringing the virus home? This kind of goes hand in hand with the question about shielding during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Okay, I'll take that one, Adam. There's no specific protocols, but I would say just be careful. So I've been encouraging patients to try to avoid contact with other people as much as possible. People that are taking care of kids or older patients with PCD should be really careful interacting with other people so that they don't get infected themselves or bring the virus home. There was questions about the whether people should put masks on going outside or not. I don't have a good feel for it, but maybe yes. I mean, if you have an access to the mask, maybe it will provide some protection. It's, again, this is not 100%. These are not the special N95 masks that give protection, and I would assume most people don't have access to them, did not undergo the fitting for these masks, so probably it's not a good idea to use them. But again, just kind of to reiterate, stay away from people, try to avoid contact with large groups, a lot of hand sanitizers, a lot of hand washing, and if you're having symptoms yourself, probably it's a good idea to try to avoid keeping a distance from your patient. Now, this is hard if you're the caregiver, but as much as you can. Adam, do you want to chip in?
No, I mean, that's it. There is a protocol for avoiding bringing it home, and it's called not leaving your house. Don't.
Correct.
House. Don't have the cleaning lady come into your house. Don't have the nanny come into your house. You need to be in a bubble for the next month, everyone in that house. And luckily, thank God, we have the internet and things to keep us busy. I cannot imagine this 25 years ago when we didn't. So don't leave your house is the key. And consider anything you touch as an infective surface. The way that most people are getting this is they're touching an infected surface and then they're touching their nose, their mouth, or their eyes. So consider your hands a deadly weapon right now. Wash them or spray them off every single chance you get. Even if you're inside your house and you think, oh, well, everyone in here is clean, they may not be. So even in between people in the house, don't eat after each other, don't drink after each other, and wash the heck out of your hands. I have small kids at home that drool all over me all the time. I know that's next to impossible, but that's what you got to do right now.
So, Adam, we have a question that gets right to this point from a registered nurse who is in Canada, and she works in the community doing home visits with the general public and has been denied accommodation to work from home because of everything that's going on. So she has considered quitting if necessary, to protect her 11-year-old with PCD. You have thoughts on that?
I think if she's got to be even more careful than the rest of us. When she comes home, all the clothes off, in the shower quickly, washing everything, don't expose your kid to anything. And if she becomes symptomatic, just stay far from the kid. I have written many notes for parents of kids with PCD and CF saying, you may not work now because I don't want you exposing your kid. And the government of Canada is giving money just like the government of the U.S. It's not coming yet, but it will be about $2,000 a month. And for some people, that's not going to be enough. But I think if there's a way that a public health nurse can avoid working, they can put her on phone calls. There are things that can be done where she doesn't have direct patient contact. And if a physician writes that note, most places are honoring it now.
That's correct. In the U.S., at least at Children's, we know that we have been giving notes to parents that have kids with PCD, as well as some of our colleagues that have chronic disease or caring for patients with immune deficiency or other lung disease, so that they can adjust their workload and potentially work from home. So again, I encourage you to stay to try to avoid working with patients if you have a kid with PCD at home that you need to care for. That might not be possible, but if it's possible, this is probably the best thing that you can do.
What about the spouses of adult patients? Would you think the same holds true there?
I've told all families to stay in the home. I've written notes saying mom and dad should not leave the house if they can. Different states in the U.S. are doing different things. Not all of them have these, you know, closing the office rules, but I've not received any pushback here from anyone so far about this.
Michelle, this is PJ McShane. Can you hear me?
Oh, hi, Dr. McShane. Yes, we can. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I thought I would just add one more point to this, all these really excellent points. Of course, the things that we can do to minimize our exposure have all been said. I think another thing to remember when we're, you know, when you're stuck at home is to remember sort of keeping your immune system as, you know, in its fighting condition. And that is, you know, getting a good 8 hours or plus more hours of sleep. This is not the time, just because, you know, you're off work, to, you know, stay up all night watching Game of Thrones. It's really important your amount of sleep should stay consistent and intact, which helps your immune system. You know, a really good diet with, you know, lots of fruits and vegetables and antioxidants to keep your immune system, you know, healthy and at its peak. And then, you know, maybe some daily exercise, continue that too. I know you don't want to go to the gym, of course, but there's, you know, all these apps on our phones that we can do to, you know, 7-minute workouts and, you know, calisthenics, and that we can make our home a workout environment that also can stimulate the immune system. So I think those maybe can be incorporated into this contact vigilance.
Thank you for that. Would you just do a brief bio so everybody knows who you are?
Oh, yeah, thanks. So I'm Pamela McShane, or PJ McShane. I have been a Chicago person for most of my career at the University of Chicago. I'm an adult bronchiectasis pulmonologist. And I just moved out to the University of Texas, where I hope to do a lot more work in non-tuberculous mycobacteria infections. And we're working hard to open up a adult center here in University of Texas at Tyler, so East Texas. Our nasal nitric oxide analyzer has been ordered.
Yay, that's great.
And we have lots of ENT physicians who are very enthusiastic about taking care of adult PCD patients in Texas.
That's wonderful. So to all of you, there a question that's come up several times, so I just think we should probably get it taken care of right now. The UK National Health Service put out guidelines for individuals who are considered extremely vulnerable. And even though PCD was not mentioned specifically, it apparently does apply to PCD. And they are talking about what they call shielding, which sounds kind of like what we're calling isolating and living in a bubble, and recommending that it be done for 12 weeks. And a lot of patients have questions about whether that that protocol should extend to people outside of the UK as well. So if you could weigh in on that, that would be helpful.
This is Amjad, definitely. Again, this is, as we mentioned before, stay at home, stay at home, stay at home. 12 weeks might sound a lot at this point, but who knows? And at least for now, I would say till the end of April, and this would probably be extended as we see more surge in the US, but stay at home, avoid people. If you're caring for kids with PCD, try to work from home as well. So yes. Definitely. Okay. Shield. Stay at home.
Just as clarification for the patient group, that recommendation is actually coming from the UK National Health Service, not from their patient group. The patient group is sharing that information just like we're sharing what's coming from the CDC. So that recommendation is from their major health service. Okay, so this is... Oh, go ahead.
Hi, Michelle. It's Ann Griffiths from Minneapolis. Sorry, I'm not on the web version. I'm just on my cell phone. I'm rounding today at Children's Minnesota. If I could interrupt and just say one thing about the stay-at-home measures. I've been stressing substantially and reiterating over and over with my families that exercise is critical. If you are deconditioning, that will set you up poorly should you need to be hospitalized. When we think about natural airway clearance measures and we think about how our stamina and our pulmonary rehab is affected if we're ill, that we really do decondition if we're only going from the bedroom to the kitchen and back to the bedroom or back to Netflix or whatever it is, and to make sure that they are really ensuring some cardio every day, going for walks outside. Various shelter-in-place orders around the country in the U.S. have allowed for outdoor activity in nature. So continuing to observe social distancing, but enforcing and ensuring within their family that they are getting some exercise.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. We know you guys are busy right now. We have a question about, is it likely that a PCD patient that recovers from COVID could have long-term permanent damage?
I can take that. We have absolutely no idea. There's some talk of some adults from China having some fibrosis in their lungs. These are reports. These are doctor to doctor, a lot of them. There's new stuff being published all the time. I'm sure PJ could go into that as well in her adults. But right now, the short answer is we do not know.
And I say, and this is PJ McShane, and I think it is a very much based on an individual case and the extent to which someone, you know, is suffering from the viral pneumonia that is associated with corona. You know, obviously a very severe case who unfortunately would tumble onto the ventilator probably would have some scarring. We do see that. But a purely positive case with sort of a viral symptomatology that doesn't require hospitalization is probably less likely to end up in lung damage and a loss of FEV1.
This is Amjad, and I agree both with Adam and with PJ. We just don't know at this time. Hopefully mild cases will not leave scarring or not affect lung function, but we truly don't know at this time.
I'm going to apologize for my dogs. I have the door closed, and if you can still hear them, I'm sorry. They're my postal alert system. Apparently the mail has arrived. So. We have a question about vest usage. This is somebody who's new to the vest, wondering what the speed should be on their vest. I don't know if that refers to should it change because of COVID, trying to avoid COVID, or is it if it's a general question, I'm not sure. Anyone want to try that one?
I'll leave it to my American colleague since we don't use the vest up here in Canada.
Yeah. You know, as promising as the vest seems, the data that supports which frequency and which vest and is not necessarily without, you know, it doesn't necessarily have the most robust data. But I agree there. I think Michelle mentioned, I don't think that it should be the settings, hertz and frequency should be different in the setting of this pandemic. I think the vest settings that you had originally when you received the prescription are probably acceptable for this current situation.
And if you haven't received that is something you'd probably need to talk to your personal physician about, because that should have been prescribed when the vest was prescribed. Okay, another question. Will it be harder for us, I think meaning people with PCD, to gauge the difference between a normal PCD flare and COVID 19 because the symptoms are similar?
That's a great question.
It is a great question. It will be hard. That's why talking to your PCD physician is important. Most of the flare-ups do not have fever with them, so high fever probably would point to a COVID infection, but the milder cases might not be with fever. And my suggestion for my patient is to treat it as a PCD flare-up until proven otherwise. So increasing the airway clearance and probably putting on antibiotics early on. And even if it was a COVID, PCD patients will still benefit from coverage as if this is a PCD flare-up.
And the only thing I think that may be even different from a regular PCD flare-up virus is if you have myalgias or body aches. That tends to be what we see with influenza or with, there's many reports of that with this coronavirus. Doesn't necessarily mean you have it, but most of my patients, and you guys could correct me if I'm wrong, all of you patients and parents on the phone, do not get body aches when they have an exacerbation. The cough increases, the mucus increases, the nose increases, the sinuses increase, but we don't normally see constitutional symptoms, which means fever, body aches, not, you know, got a lot of fatigue, and that's what, at least in the cases that are symptomatic, we're tending to see with the coronavirus.
It's Ann Griffiths. It's also been interesting to say that if your family member was sick with a viral infection, that sneezing has not been a classic symptom of COVID. So if your family member had significant sneezing on the onset, which certainly would look different in PCD, but in the non-PCD affected family member whom you may have gotten this from, it may be less likely to be COVID if there was significant sneezing in that caregiver or family member.
Oh, that's interesting. We have a question here, and I think this is a good just general question, asking if there's a difference between Carter-Gaynar syndrome and PCD. So this would be a good time to explain what the difference is there.
Carter-Gaynar is a subtype of PCD. These are the classical description of the patients that have status inversus totalis. Carter-Gaynar is PCD I would just call it PCD. This is an old description that we should try to avoid using at this point. I'm just calling everybody PCD.
Thank you so much for that. So I think for the patient group, if you understand that PCD can present in one of three ways, no situs problems, situs inversus totalis, which is also called Carter-Gaynar syndrome because that's an older name, or situs ambiguous. So those are all PCD. It's just with PCD, you can present in one of these three ways. So the underlying problem is all PCD. It's just a different organ presentation. Okay. Question, what about a home care nurse coming in to flush your port for the next month? Should you request a self-care order to flush your own port?
Great question.
Oh, I think absolutely. If you're comfortable with flushing your own port and can do it, don't let someone come in your house. Even if that person says they're not symptomatic, we now have evidence that people can be shedding the virus for days before they're symptomatic. They can be quite contagious. So yeah, if you know how to do it and you're not going to mess it up and you have the right equipment and you can do it in a sterile or clean fashion like they want you to, then absolutely.
Okay, I'm just kind of scrolling through questions here. We have a lot of good ones.
While you're looking for the next question, this is PJ McShane. I'd like to have the other panel members weigh in on this. I think, to sort of balance out the significant and appropriate concern about your exposure now, the idea here is that the virus is going to, decrease. And in the meantime, we're going to be working on a vaccine. And by the next wave of this, which, probably will have some cyclical nature to it, the way influenza does, that, we're going to be able to be, weaponized or, get the vaccine the next time. And so I hope that, that there aren't people listening out there that think that this is, we're going to have to do this every year or at this point, I don't think there's a reason to be concerned about that, I think the vaccine is a realistic hope that down the line, we won't have to do this again. I'm very interested in what the other panels feel about that.
This is Amjad. This is my hope as well. With the number of companies and universities trying to find a vaccine, workable vaccine, hopefully by the next time we need to deal with this, we will have something to offer. Again, this is my hope as well.
So I think it kind of, that gets directly to the next question we had, is when is it going to be safe to start venturing into society? And I think it's nice to have a little bit of positive, some positive things to say here. There is a lot going on in vaccine development and coming up with better therapies. And I think on a call last week, one of Dr. Irv from NCATS at the National Institutes of Health had mentioned that for a lot of patients, we've gone beyond the initial shock and how do we isolate ourselves to now trying to figure out how we're going to live with this long term until a vaccine or something becomes available. And that's tricky. And I think this is new for everybody. Nobody's really had to, in our lifetimes, had to deal with this. So just be aware that there is a lot of stuff going on and it's happening quickly. And so hopefully there'll be some positive news in the very near future here.
Well, I would say to everyone, cancel all of your April. There's no one should leave their house for the whole month of April. And I think it's really going to depend on how quickly it explodes and maybe burns out in the United States. It might be May as well, but at least April for now. Even after the general public starts going back, people with underlying conditions may take even longer. Until there's a vaccine, I don't see how we can say you're guaranteed if you leave your house in June to be fine. I've been speaking to a lot of patients with frail children, with tracheostomies and on ventilators and with immune deficiencies. And they tell me, welcome to our world. This is how we've been living every day for our whole life, afraid of germs, afraid of microbes. We're really good with hand washing and sterilizing our hands. And I imagine a lot of people on this call are already hyper-vigilant about those things. And that's good. That's going to save you. But don't let that hypervigilance wane, even when it may be safe to go out. I think this is a lesson for all of us that, no, we can't live in a bubble and be petrified of germs, but we can wash our hands 20, 30 times a day and bring Purell with us and things like that and not, shake hands with someone who's coughing. And I think that's kind of going to be our new way of life for the next at least year, I would say. We'll be leaving our house, but we're all going to be cautious.
I mean, in some ways we are probably ahead of the curve because this patient community already knows that sharing germs is not good, and there's no such thing as it's just the flu. The flu can be very, very bad when you get PCD. So we're already kind of prepared to do this stuff, and I think that's been helpful. And I think the other thing that's nice about this is, not nice, nothing is nice about this, but now people understand. So when you now say, I can't be in this group because I'm afraid of getting infected with something, that's something everyone can relate to now. Everybody's afraid of cross-infection. So it brings a little bit of awareness to our patient, people that deal with our patient population about what it's like to live with an underlying disorder. We have several questions about therapies. Pulmozyme, is it okay to use that? Should we be nebulizing, or is that going to aerosolize the virus potentially? And will taking Zithromax every other day help PCDers?
This is Amjad again from Childress. I have not been using Pulmozyme for most of my PCD patients. I don't know if Adam has been using it.
Use hypertonic saline a lot.
Yeah.
But same risk with the aerosolization.
Right. Now, if you're not sick, probably using aerosolization should not be an issue. It's mostly to spreading the virus to other people. So as long as you're not sick and people around you are not sick and you're doing it in your room, I think it should be okay. And I don't want to encourage anybody to stop doing their routine medications and routine treatments at this point. As far as the azithromycin, we don't have enough evidence to suggest that it affects the virus at this point. That said, for those that are already using azithromycin as part of the routine care, continue doing that.
There is some concern that if we have patients with PCD or CF or other issues hospitalized with COVID, that nebulizations like Pulmozyme and hypertonic saline can absolutely spread the virus to others. So our hospital is rigging up one-way filtration systems on these nebulizers so that they can still be given. But that has been a big discussion amongst a lot of the lung doctors across the world on one of our big chat groups called Peed Lung. We're not doing nebulizations in the emergency room, even for asthma and things like that. We hadn't been for a while. We'd been using puffers. But if a child comes in with croup, you sometimes will give epinephrine nebulizers, and that can actually spread it throughout the whole ER. So they're not doing that now. So I will say, if, God forbid, anyone in this group is hospitalized and does have to continue using their nebulizers, their hospital is going to have to come up with a very safe way to do it, such as in a negative pressure room and things like that, because they absolutely can spread the virus.
Yeah, Adam said is correct. In the hospitals, at least in St. Louis, we have stopped using NIP medications for most of our patients for fear of spreading viral infections, especially the COVID. My comment was at using the medications at home when you're not sick and there's no evidence of a COVID infection.
That's right. Keep using all your inhaled therapies at home. Yes.
Okay, we're getting some feedback from our adult patients that when they have a flare of a PCD Pseudomonas flare, they do get get fevers and also body aches. So would there be other signals they should be looking for?
No, I had a feeling someone was going to come and tell me I was wrong, because I have a pediatric perspective. So that's great. Thank you for that information. Then this could seem just like that. So it's really going to be getting tested to find out you have it, isolating yourself, and taking care of yourself.
We have a question. Is there a benefit to adding prophylactic antibiotic when that's used when you flare up to a non-flare up situation?
I would say no. If you're at your baseline and doing well, there's no reason to go on antibiotics. If you're at that stage, have an exacerbation. My patients often have more than 5 to 7 days to increase symptoms, or if they're really feeling bad, then yeah, you go on antibiotics. But antibiotics do not treat a virus. They only treat the bacteria that's already in your lungs. And so there's no reason to go on any prophylactic antibiotics unless you're symptomatic.
I agree with Adam on that. No reason to start prophylactic antibiotics at this time.
Can we have everybody who's not one of our physician speakers go on mute, please, just so we don't get back. Then we have a question. Does COVID-19 present like the flu or more like pneumonia?
So that's a case of spectrum. We're talking about here with COVID-19 that it's a viral pneumonia, and so the initial symptoms are going to be that of a virus, the achiness, the dry cough, the headache, the fatigue, marked fatigue, and then as it progresses and becomes more severe, if it progresses and becomes more severe, a patient may have chest discomfort that's indicative of a pneumonia. So it's really a case of spectrum when it and severity.
So we're getting a lot of questions about ports and what they are, which is not directly COVID related, but if one of you wants to just explain what a port is.
Port is like kind of like a PICC line that always stays in. It's underneath the skin, usually in the chest, and you access it with a little curved needle. If you have lots and lots of hospitalizations every year, sometimes they'll just put in a port because it just stays there and you don't have to get a PICC line every time. And often patients with cancer and other things that need a lot of IV medications have it. So it's covered by, if you have it, you know exactly what it is. If you don't have it, don't worry about it.
So again, can we get everybody to mute? We're having a little feedback issue. So a question about, is it still okay to go outdoors even if you happen to be crossing people on trails and you're closer than 6 feet?
I would avoid going out if you are if there are a lot of people around you and you can't keep a safe distance.
Okay, and how do you feel about the FDA granting emergency approval for hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin therapy?
Wait. We're hearing reports of toxicity. Wait.
Yeah, people are very hopeful. There is no magic bullet for this. As much as leaders want you to think there is not. The magic bullet is staying in your home and not getting infected. That's it. There's no magic pill, and some of those can be harmful. And just to let people know, we've been using hydroxychloroquine in all sorts of diseases, autoimmune diseases. It's not a brand new drug that we forgot about. It's an old malaria drug that we've used in all sorts of autoinflammatory diseases. It's theoretical that it may help based on studies in petri dishes. It is not ready for prime time use, and it is not the magic bullet.
Could you just say a word about, I mean, I think people are getting the idea that this is, because it's been around a long time, a completely safe drug combo. And I think people need to understand that it doesn't come without risks.
No, every medication comes with risks. If you take it wrong or you have an underlying liver problem, it can severely hurt you. It's just like any med. Don't take it without a doctor's orders, and those doctors need to be familiar with it. I think a lot of hoopla has been made of it, and I wish it was that helpful, but it's really not been proven at all to be that helpful. People are using it in the intensive care units with dying patients because at that point the benefits outweigh the risks, but there are risks and people need to know about it.
Yeah, this is not a safe medication. It can have significant cardiac problems, especially for patients that are already using azithromycin or other medications that can affect the rhythm in the heart. Again, this is not a safe medication. It's not ready for prime time. We do not know if it's really effective in COVID. And the data out there is not strong enough, and we just need to wait and see if it's actually effective.
A question about any advice for PCD patients who work in the healthcare field.
Try to work from home and not see patients, or try and do clerical jobs and not see patients if you absolutely can.
Yeah, I agree. Stay at home.
So this is
we have a lot of nurses doing phone calls, and we're keeping them very, very busy. Also, our doctors over age 60, we're trying our best not to have them see patients. They're doing phone consults, phone calls, administrative work. I think as you get older, your risk for having bad outcomes is worse. So I think it's important to try and not catch it.
So are you any of you doing video telehealth or other forms of telehealth during this?
We this is Amjad again from Children's. We have started doing some telehealth for our return patients that we already know them, and we have some contact with them before. We're just starting to roll it out. It's different. It doesn't replace seeing your provider, but at this time it's the best that we can offer. And I assume other institutions will start rolling this out as long as we see that this COVID shelter in place order is in place.
Yeah, we're 100% telephone in Montreal, telephone or internet visits. That's all.
As are we at University of Texas.
So I think this is a really interesting question from Rebecca, that her PCD kids never have a dry cough. There's always mucus. Any idea on how you would distinguish this with COVID, since dry cough is what we're hearing about with PCD kids, probably isn't going to be dry, right?
You know, I think it's at this point, we're still gathering data about how the United States patient presents with COVID. You know, we're looking at Chinese data that's now published in the New England Journal and how they presented, but it's not always exactly the same in two different continents. So, you know, I think it strikes me that there may be some subtle differences in the character of the cough and the character of how one feels with their exacerbation when they get COVID. Now, you know, everyone with PCD has this sort of almost fingerprint of how they know their exacerbations are presenting. And I suspect that there's just going to be a slightly different character that you'll be able to pick up on, you know, that is not very typical of your usual exacerbation. Having said that, I would say any increase in symptoms are something that you need to pay attention to and potentially pursue testing if you think that this is really a marked change from your baseline.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know that we're ever going to have symptoms specific enough that someone's going to be able to say, oh, aha, that symptom was this. I think you hear it on TV, but it's not really studied in an organized manner. And now we know there are a lot of people who are almost completely asymptomatic and have it too. So I think it's going to be across the board. And I think you need to treat this as you would any exacerbation. If things are getting worse, call your doctor. They'll advise you whether or not to get testing for it. And they might give you an antibiotic for the bacteria that's already in your sinuses and lungs. But I don't know that we're ever going to be able to say, aha, this symptom equals COVID. I just don't think it's possible now. And I don't know if it's ever going to be possible because so many people present so differently.
Would it be safe to say that you're probably paying more attention to things that aren't typical than are typical for you?
I think so. Everyone's going to be different, Michelle. I don't think anyone's going to be able to pinpoint that one symptom that makes it COVID or not. That's why we have to do all this testing and swabs in the nose to really know for sure.
Okay. This is a good question. Why is viral pneumonia more deadly than bacterial pneumonia?
I don't think that's more deadly. Yeah. Oh. I was going to say, I don't think that's true.
It depends on the pathogen. It depends on what caused the pneumonia. People can unfortunately die from bacterial pneumonia. They can also die from viral pneumonia. Pneumonia is bad regardless.
Yeah. Okay, how long should we avoid elective procedures, non-emergent procedures?
Like this goes with the staying in your house. First off, no hospitals should be doing elective procedures now. If they are, that's completely irresponsible of them, really. If it's truly elective, they're semi-urgent and semi-elective, but truly elective should not be done now. The healthcare system can't cover it. And the second thing is, I would not leave your house for an elective procedure until this is over. So, if you're in pain or something like that because you need your gallbladder out and it's causing issues, that's one thing to talk to your doctor about. But truly elective procedures, like getting a crown put on your tooth or something like that where you're not in pain, don't leave your house for that until this is over.
This is a good question, and it kind of gets to antibody testing after somebody thinks they may have had and recovered from COVID-19. PCD thinks they may have been exposed in January after traveling to the West Coast, both got ill. And will people who in this position who think they may have recovered from it be able to get testing for antibodies?
Yeah, this is Amjad. I'm not sure that antibody testing is offered routinely. Most of the tests currently on the market or in the hospitals are PCR, qPCR based tests. I'm not sure. Adam, do you have different experience?
Well, that's going to be the million-dollar question to see how many of us have already been exposed and done fine. The problem is the antibodies in coronavirus do not last long. It's not like chickenpox where you can tell you were infected 20 years ago. And that's part of the reason that the vaccine becomes so difficult. So for the flu shot, we give you a shot once a year and the antibodies last about, 8 to 10 months. The problem with this is the antibodies go away fairly quickly. So it's going to take a lot of smart people thinking about this because you're not going to go and vaccinate a bunch of people, the entire United States, when let's say 50% have already been exposed and formed their own antibodies and survived it. So that's coming, but I think that's going to be the kind of stuff we're looking at this summer and fall. And I don't know anyone that's doing any testing for antibodies because it's so difficult with coronavirus.
There was a news report about a town in Colorado that's going to do antibody testing on their entire population. So hopefully that will provide some info.
It very well could be that 80% of us have already had this and didn't even realize it, in which case we're not the people you want to rush to vaccinate. We want to rush to vaccinate the people with PCD that haven't had this to protect them. And so I think it's a very interesting question. And like all the other questions, we just don't know enough yet.
And I'm apologizing for my dogs. I have to live like a mole with all the windows closed or they bark at everything. So PJ, did you have something?
No, I was just, I think you might have just heard me chuckle a little bit about the dogs. As you know, I'm a, I also worry about my dogs barking on conference calls.
Okay, we have a question about precautions when things are being delivered. Groceries, I know some people are ordering food and having it delivered as a way to kind of help the support the restaurant industry in their local area. Should we be doing that? Should we be wiping down everything? And this would apply, of course, to mail too.
Yeah. Deliver, it's a good question. I would say have the delivery person put the item on the ground and leave before you pick it up, so at least that you don't need to interact with the person. It's not nice to that person. It's not too personal, but I think keeping a safe distance is important at this time. As far as wiping, if it comes in a box, in a plastic box, yes, go ahead and wipe it. The virus does survive for a couple of hours on cardboard and paper. Now, the likelihood of it being on that cardboard, kind of if you get mail or a package from Amazon, is very low. But I don't see any harm of wiping or washing your hands, at least when you open the package, after you open the package.
I will say this. We have a Subway in our hospital, not the train, the sandwich shop. And the young girl at Subway was coughing and hacking all over people's sandwiches all weekend. Didn't really tell anyone. And finally, security got called and escorted her to be COVID tested. And now the Subway is taped down with plastic. So I think as much as you want to support takeout, I'll tell you, I'm not doing takeout in this time. I think you've got to weigh your risks and benefits. If you can cook your own food, cook your own food. If you want to give a donation to your restaurant industry, well, you can do that and take their food. But I personally wouldn't take anything from anyone right now that they could have coughed on, wiped their nose on, or anything like
that. We have a couple of feedback from Bernard Windelschbacher from Switzerland. He is a PCD member of this group, and he also a physician. And he said that there are tests for antibodies starting in Switzerland right now. And then we had kind of a follow-up question. If the antibodies are short-lasting, does that mean a person can be reinfected?
Great question. And the answer is we don't know, but that's one of the most concerning things. Could you even be infected with the exact same coronavirus again, even if the strains haven't changed? We don't know. Your body is very good at remaking antibodies. It has memory. So even if you've seen that once, the next time around, you should be better protected and the cold or the symptoms should be milder. But that is a real concern. The antibody stuff is in its infancy right now. People are still just trying to know who has it. Again, I think this summer is going to be the antibody talk is going to come.
Is there a possibility that this will end up like the seasonal flu where you don't get one vaccination and you're done for good? It may have to be repeated over and over every year.
It may be. So far there's been no evidence that the virus strains have changed. They've stayed mostly the same. This isn't like influenza where you have H1N3 and H1N1. This coronavirus has stayed pretty similar, but you know, who knows what's going to happen after half the United States has caught it? We just don't know. Sorry, Amjad, you're a laboratory guy. What do you think?
Oh, no, I agree with you. The virus that have left China has not mutated so far, but it doesn't mean that it will not mutate in 2 or 3 or in a year from now. And unfortunately, whenever these things mutate a bit, then the body doesn't recognize them as well as before. So the short answer is maybe. Maybe we will be dealing with cyclic infections like the flu. And if there's a vaccine, maybe the vaccine need to be repeated every year. We just don't know. We don't have enough evidence or enough data to make that call yet. We need to wait and see.
So we're getting some questions that are kind of are country specific, and we know that there's a lot of similarities between how countries are responding to this, and there are also some differences. So I'm not sure we can probably address each of those, but I think the general recommendation to isolate and stay away from people is true across the board. And just because people are asking, this is being recorded, so we will post this so everybody can listen to the question and answer sessions after this if you were late or missed some of it. There's a question about a horse barn issue, and I promise this didn't come from my daughter. This came from another group. It has to do with, is it safe to go to a horse barn where there may not be a lot of people if you practice social distancing.
Horses, as far as we know, don't carry that virus. I'm not worried from the horses. I'm worried from the people around the horses. So if you can be sure that there will not be people around you to infect you, maybe I would still say stay at home. Unless you have to leave, stay at home.
Yeah, and I just want to reiterate that. You know, one of the problems is the hospitals cannot shut down completely. People still have heart attacks, still have strokes, still get in car wrecks, still break a leg. You don't want to be in the hospital right now for a broken leg after getting thrown off a horse. It's the absolute wrong time. So I would say low-risk activities are the smart thing right now, even if you are going to leave your house. You just don't want to be in an ER right now getting exposed to things. So think about that before you go do steeplechase or something that might be a little bit dangerous.
Megan, are you on this call? I'm hoping.
My wife is a horse person too, and we're not going to the barn, so.
We have a question about, somebody is asking about the new CF drug that's recently been approved and how that might have implications for PCD.
I can talk about that a little. So there was a study, it's public knowledge, a few years ago with Perion, where they actually used an inhaled medication called an ENaC inhibitor, and they actually combined it with one of these new CF meds called Ivacaftor. I can't say anything about the results because it's under embargo right now, but Michelle, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there should be some information soon. But that's the only trial that I know of that has used these type of new CF meds in PCD. The mechanism of action is very different, so I don't think people would expect it to work like it does in CF, but more will be public very soon.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
We have a question about the possibility of passive vaccination from people who have gone through the disease. I think it's being called convalescent serum here in the news.
Yeah, there's a WashU is carrying some trials on that at this time. We still don't have enough data. It might work. This has worked before in other disease processes, but again, at this time, there's not enough data to say that it will work. And I would say just wait. Let the scientists, let the physician do what they know how to do best. And hopefully some of these trials will produce good results that all of us will benefit from. At this time, there's no evidence that it works.
Can you just...
And in fact the American College, I think, of Critical Care, I can't remember his name, actually came out with some patient treatment guidelines recently. And they actually said, do not give intravenous immunoglobulin or IVIG, which is kind of the serum and the antibodies from a whole lot of people pooled together. And if some of those people had this coronavirus, you could assume there might be antibodies in there, but they won't be in a high enough concentration like a convalescent serum where you actually take it from someone that's recently had it. So they're not routinely giving IVIG in these cases in the ICUs.
So could you just explain briefly what it is so people understand what the rationale is for thinking about it?
Yeah, so the idea is to take a person who have contracted COVID and then recovered from it and take the blood out and filter out the good antibodies. And these antibodies then can be given to a patient that is currently sick with COVID with the hope that these antibodies will help them recover faster. Now, in theory, that would work and that sounds great. There's a lot of problems with this approach. Because one, you're giving a foreign body and foreign materials from a different person that can by itself cause side effects. And two, we do not know if it actually would work. If the antibodies filtered out from a patient that just recovered from COVID would benefit somebody else. There's not enough data to suggest that it would work. And this still requires a lot of work by the scientists and the physicians working on that subject.
So again, we're back to prevention of acquiring the virus is probably better than anything that could be done to treat it.
That's correct.
Okay, so we have a question. I would assume this probably applies to a lot of families right now, that the kids are going back and forth between households. mom's house and then dad's house. Should they just stay at one house now and not be doing visitations?
Good question. Probably yes. I would avoid moving back and forth between different places at this time. Now the logistics of this might be problematic if a person is kind of sharing custody of a child, but probably yes, just stay put in one place.
Yeah, the least number of people you're exposed to, the more protected you are. That being said, moms and dads and kids shouldn't be separated unless someone's really sick or something like that. So that's kind of common sense and up to the individual family.
We have a question about how important is Pulmozyme for PCD?
I have not been using Pulmozyme for most of my PCD patients. It might work on a case-to-case scenario, so some patients might benefit from it, but I do not think that we can generally say give it to everybody.
I think that really matches with the experience of most of the PCD clinical centers. It is not as commonly used at PCD clinical center sites as it is at other sites for PCD.
And again, it's tough to get. I'm sorry. It's tough to get if Pulmozyme is FDA approved for cystic fibrosis, and insurance companies often use that to not approve it for patients who have primary ciliary dyskinesia. And so, you know, I've had several adult patients whose PCD diagnosis came a little later in life. And so they kind of began getting Pulmozyme before they realized that they did not have CF. So they, you know, sort of weren't diagnosed yet. Cystic fibrosis was possible on the table for their diagnosis, and they got Pulmozyme that way. And then once their diagnosis was more clear, insurance companies start those are the type of patients that I inherit sort of on Pulmozyme. And then if they change their insurance company or the next year rolls around, it's often very hard to get it. And we have to write appeal letters to say, you know, this patient's on Pulmozyme and, you know, we think it helped this one individual patient. So it's, you know, even if we decided, oh, you know, we do think it helps with PCD, it may require, you know, a randomized controlled or placebo controlled study to prove that so that the FDA would approve it and then insurance companies would pay for it more easily.
Yeah. And we've been, you know, there's been discussions about doing that sort of a trial with the company, and they are not particularly interested in doing that right now because their other non-CF bronchiectasis trials have not been very, have actually worked against them. So that I don't know that we can really count on that anytime in the near future either. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but I think that's.
Yeah.
And in those studies on non-CF bronchiectasis, some people got sick more on Pulmozyme. So I think that has to be remembered. And frankly, that's part of the reason why a lot of us in PCD have shied away from Pulmozyme, because it even worsened some people with non-CF bronchiectasis. Not PCD specifically, but.
I think this, go ahead. Amjad, did you have something to add to that?
No, I agree. I mean, as I mentioned, I have not been using it routinely in most of my patients, and I would avoid using it. Maybe some patients would benefit from it, but this needs to be discussed with the PCD physician, and this needs to be decided on a case by case. I do not, we can't give a recommendation to use Pulmozyme for PCD patients at this time. I don't think it would work. It might, as Adam said, might actually make you sicker.
So we are coming up on the hour here, and I'm sorry if we missed your question. There is one that I think is important because I think this is on a lot of people's minds. With ventilator shortages, I think patients that have underlying conditions are afraid that they may be one of the groups that is not offered ventilator assistance if they should get very sick. Any comments on that? Would PCD be in that list of people who don't get vented?
I don't think so. I hope not. There are some ventilator shortages because at least in the US, we're using intubations and ventilations more than non-invasive ventilation, the BiPAP, because of fear of spreading the virus. There are no recommendations to not offer ventilation to patients with chronic lung disease. We are not at that point. Hopefully we'll never reach that point. And physicians, your physicians will fight for you. We will fight for you. Don't worry about that. Just worry about not getting sick.
Thank you for that. So
by the way, Michelle, there is no list that I know of anywhere that someone has suggested, oh, these diseases should not be intubated and get ventilators. There's no list. There's no, I call that the God list. That doesn't exist. In Italy, they've done it by age, as their system was completely, utterly overwhelmed. They are not intubating people above age 70. And that is from direct kind of doctor-to-doctor communications. I don't know that there's an actual document or edict that says that. So I don't want people to think that there's any kind of list. I've heard of nothing like that saying, this is the group we're going to let go. That is not true in North America.
So I think what happened here is that we had a document come out, and this was not COVID-19 specific. It was lists of people that would be expected to do better or worse on ventilation. And one of the lists did include people that had cognitive disabilities, and that kind of opened up the whole can of worms about what constitutes a disability. But I do think it's important for people to know that the Civil Rights Department, the agency that oversees that in the US, immediately clamped down on that. And so that is not the legal status now. So just so people know that, hopefully that won't ever be something we have to worry about. I think we should probably close up now, and I apologize if we missed your question, but we are wanting to do this again. We talked about doing it weekly. However, we do know our physicians are very, very busy, and we don't want to impose on their time either. So we will attempt to do this again. Thank you all so much for participating. So all of the physicians on the call, just want you to know we got multiple people thanking you for your time and appreciating your advice here. So we are very grateful as a group.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is going to be recorded. We'll get the recording up as soon as we can. Thanks, everyone.